Novelist Orson Scott Card has written a number of books and materials that deal with a futuristic military conflict. Ender's Game was released in 1985, and Ender's Shadow in 1999. And in this, mankind is threatened by an alien species, but it continues to wrestle with issues of deep meaning, especially destruction, deception, innocence, and guilt. In Ender's Shadow, the later book, we have this conversation that takes place. Do you know why Satan is so angry all the time? Because whenever he works a particularly clever bit of mischief, God uses it to serve his own righteous purposes. The response is, so God uses wicked people as his tools? God gives us freedom to do great evil if we choose. Then he uses his own freedom to create goodness out of that evil, for that is what he chooses. So, in the long run, God wins? Yes. In the short run, though, it can be uncomfortable. Now, that needs maybe a little more theological nuance, but I think it's insightful, and it ties us into the journey that we've been on now for many weeks with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and now as we come to the end of Genesis with Joseph. You know, to say that the short term can be uncomfortable in our lives might be the understatement of the hour, but to affirm that God works through us to accomplish his good will is a theme that has it's emerged over and over again over the last couple of months. And it brings together various strands of this story as God is in the process of keeping his promises. You know, I'm sorry that Joseph is just one day in the lectionary readings because, you know, he's his own long narrative and a very rich person and story, just, you know, so full of many themes. So we can only look at a couple of major points that I think, at least that I feel jump out at me, but they bring unity to the whole story of Abraham's family. And not only that, they put us right into the story as well. So here are the two themes. You won't have to search for them hard today. I'll put them right up front. The first is this. Our role in God's story is greater than we think. And secondly, God's role in our story is much more than we often know. Our role in God's story is greater than we think, and God's role in our story is often much more than we know. How can we summarize Joseph's life? I mean, there's chapter after chapter here. He's Jacob's son. Remember Jacob. He's Jacob's favorite son. Born of Jacob's favorite wife. Singled out for special attention by his father. You may remember he's given a beautiful multicolored coat and extravagance that plays on these issues of favoritism and brings about issues of envy. Joseph's kind of a royal pain to his older brothers. He is. He's a tattletale. He's spoiled. He's cocky. He taunts them through dreams of his superiority. And so the other brothers do what brothers do in situations like this. They decide to kill him. Or at least that's sometimes what brothers would like to do. But along the way, one or two of the brothers intercede, and they decide not to kill him, but to send him away. Let's just get rid of him. And so they sell him into slavery. He's trafficked away into Egypt. And there, Joseph actually does pretty well. He does well. He's connected to an important household, and the household prospers. But he's placed into prison after he's wrongly accused. And in prison, he's forgotten there by those that he had helped. He's only finally released from prison when Pharaoh has disturbing dreams that he cannot understand, And an ex-prisoner remembers Joseph, and he says, oh, there was this guy in prison that has the ability, the gift, to interpret dreams. I'd forgotten all about him. Pharaoh summons Joseph, and he's able to understand these dreams. Joseph tells Pharaoh what they mean. Good years are coming, but after the good years, famine is coming. 7 good years, 7 years of famine. And what it means is there's actually time to prepare. There's time to get ready. And Joseph says, you're going to need somebody really pretty good to oversee this process. And Pharaoh says, how about you? And he's placed into great authority, like prime minister, really, over all of Egypt. Things go well with Joseph. Grain is stored. The nation is ready to face famine. And then it comes. And the whole world now must come to Egypt to buy food. And down from Canaan, on behalf of their aging father, some 22 years after they had sold him into slavery, come Joseph's brothers to seek food, to find aid in a desperate bid to avoid starvation. And what happens next over the few chapters is really too complicated in the story to summarize. So we're just going to skip over it and land where we start today, where we have the reading today, because it really takes us to that point where Joseph, this exalted ruler in Egypt, finally reveals his identity to his brothers. Now, they've been meeting with him. They saw him on several occasions. There had been even some kind of, he'd been sort of teasing them and playing with them and so on. Probably not even, speaking a language different than them through an interpreter. And how would they recognize him? And he was separated from them. They couldn't even be in the same place. He was high and stood apart from them. But finally, he couldn't take it anymore. So he sends away all the Egyptians, all those who wait on him, all those who are in his business group. He says, everybody leave. And he's left alone, he and his brothers. And he begins to weep. This story has always touched me at that deeply emotional level, probably because I only have brothers. And also because Joseph's such a vulnerable person, even in the midst of his power. Tears can be a sign of personal pain. They can be bitter. Those are usually not helpful tears. But tears can also be signs of surrender, of letting go. And I think, we see that when Jacob and Esau meet. They have tears together. There's an overwhelming of emotion, and all of that passes or hasn't passed between them over the years is released in tears, because words just don't suffice. And so in the tears and the weeping, Joseph lets go of all the years. He releases his right to be angry, which is what forgiveness is. He releases his right to be angry, and he reveals his identity. The brothers aren't sure it's a good thing that they're now standing in front of Joseph. They're terrified, the text says, right? Because he has the power of life and death over them now. But he tells them not to be distressed. Don't be anxious or worried because of what they had done. And in that moment, Joseph forgave them. He began a process of reconciliation that was marked by tears and embracing and conversation. Now, I think Joseph really had a choice to make, didn't he? I mean, this wasn't a text that he was following. He was given a choice. And in that choice, he was given a substantial part in the story that God was working out. I mean, what would have happened, really, if he had refused to forgive his brothers? Or decided to put them in the dungeon, or sent them home with no food? Joseph could have opposed the very will of God. He could have done that. And the promised people could have been cut off and left with no hope. They could have been starved right into the ground of the promised land. See, Joseph's role in the great narrative of God's salvation was greater than he knew. And I believe that's true for us as well. That's my first point. God risks so much on weak, sinful, broken, and misguided people that he has called to himself and chosen in his love. I mean, we've seen that in the story of Abraham's family, haven't we? I mean, look at Abraham. What a guy. He's a coward. He's kind of a cheat, a liar. I mean, all of these things. Sarah, she doesn't really believe. Isaac, all the favoritism, and Jacob, and all of the trickery, and all that had gone on, and we say, really, is that the best you could do? We see it in the choice when Jesus chooses his disciples, just a ragtag bunch. And again, we wonder, we're not sure about your selection process. And we know it especially when we look in the mirror. At least I do. See, God calls us and gives us the gift of being his children. And he says, go, do the work I've given you to do in the power of the Spirit. So much has been placed in our hands to do. So much more than we think or even understand. Our choices, words, and actions have eternal dimensions and consequences. I think it's part of what it means when Jesus says to his disciples, whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. That's from Matthew 18. It's a passage where Jesus is telling them how to deal with conflict in the Christian community. Joseph forgives. And he plays a vital role in God fulfilling his purposes and providing for his promise. When we forgive, we make possible the work of God through his kingdom. We're doing something that's far more important and necessary than may seem in the moment. One of the things I commonly hear about forgiveness is this, that it's a gift you give to yourself. Forgive the other person so you can sleep at night. Just forgive them, and then you can move on. And you know, sometimes that might be the best that we can do. But as Neil Plantinga reminds us, that's not the biblical concept of forgiveness. When the Bible talks of forgiveness, it's not that. Forgiveness is a gift to the other person and to yourself, so that relationship in the Christian community can be sustained and deepened and enriched. Jesus doesn't say, you must forgive your brother or sister countless times just so you can go your own way, but in order that there remains fellowship, because we are the reconciled people of God, the ones he has bought with a price. Joseph knew what we can also know, that forgiveness paves the way for divine imagination so that we can see one another as God sees us. When I forgive you, when you forgive me, we're playing a larger role in God's story than we know, a role that God has given to us. In other words, I have a responsibility for you, I do. Not just because I'm pastor, I have responsibility for you as your brother, and you have responsibility for me. It's sort of the Jesus Creed, isn't it? It's the part that tells us we must love our neighbor as ourself. A second theme I find in the narrative is that God's role in our story, that is the events of our lives, God's role is much larger sometimes than we see. I mean, do we know that? Are we open to seeing the hand of God, his mercies, his provisions in our life? After Joseph meets with his brothers here in this passage, his father Jacob is brought down to Egypt, and all the families and all that they have, and they relocate, and they settle there. And Jacob dies in Egypt. He dies there, but Joseph had promised him that he would take him back to Canaan and bury him. And it's interesting, Jacob had placed in his will something to be given to Joseph, which was, please forgive my sons for what they did to you. Joseph had already forgiven them, but there had not been full reconciliation then because they still lived in fear of him. They hadn't received the forgiveness. So they come to him with this reading and saying, you know, our father said before he died to please forgive us. And Joseph weeps again. And he says, yeah, you're right. You did mean evil to me, but God meant it for good so that many would be kept alive as they are today. So don't fear. I will provide for you and your little ones. Joseph saw that as painful as the past was, God somehow was in it and was turning it into good. Joseph didn't say, yes, that's right, you made me a victim. He didn't. He acknowledged the truth of that evil, but then the greater truth of God's sovereign purpose. You know, when we're trusting God, when we see that God is working in our lives, doing his will, working out his good purposes, then that's a great thing to celebrate. There are terrible things that happen, yes, and great injustice that's carried out every day throughout the world. But as God's people, we're to work for good, seek to right wrongs, and take the long view, trusting in God. Joseph said, this is what God was doing in the midst of all that stuff. God was working, and you didn't even know it. Joseph's affirmation reminds us that God is more active in our lives than sometimes we're willing to admit. God often risks his plans on us. Can we risk our lives on him? Walter Brueggemann has a commentary on Genesis that's actually quite poetic and creative. I really enjoy it. And he says that the sovereign character of God's purpose can create a real newness, or if you will, a genesis. A freshness in our lives that negates the past, redefines the present, and opens futures. I mean, think about that. In the creation, in the first several chapters of Genesis, God is making, God is bringing forth and speaking forth, and at each step along the way, what does God say? He says, it's good. He declares that it's good. The word means it follows God's intention. It's beautiful, it's right, it's ordered, and it's full of promise. As God works in our lives, as we respond to his life in us, God is restoring the work of creation, of reclaiming and making and calling it good. In the Chronicles of Narnia, Lucy is not given a weapon of war. She's given a weapon of healing. She's given a cordial that she's to pour a drop onto the wounds, and people are to know healing. And what does she do? She puts a drop, and then she declares, cured! God touches us, works in and through the various elements of our lives, and says, good! And God can do this in the most difficult situations. It helps if we're willing partners. It helps a lot. We're at the very end of Genesis. Joseph is dying after a full life with his family in Egypt. And he calls his brothers together, the brothers that remain, I guess. And he says to them in chapter 50, verse 24, he says, I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. After all that we've walked through with all of this family, and remember, there's still hundreds of years of slavery yet to come down in Egypt, Joseph is recalling with his dying words the goodness of God. The hope that God is not far away, but is here calling us home. And there is where we find faith. So our part in God's story is bigger than we think sometimes. God's activity in our story is much more than we often will recognize. You know, it's a story of doing God's work through faith that is particularly meaningful and has been to me, especially in recent years. There was a young Jewish boy living in an area of Transylvania, and he loved the Torah. He studied the Torah, and he would fast and pray for the coming of the Jewish Messiah. But the Messiah that he saw didn't come. Instead, the Nazis came. And little by little, family by family, destroyed their community and took them off to concentration camps. And this boy, with the profound faith in God, had it beaten out of him night after night after night. Until finally, as one Jewish man was hanged in the concentration camp, he writes this. He says, "Behind me I heard a man asking, 'For God's sake, where is God?' And from within me I heard a voice answer, 'Where is he? This is where, hanging here from this gallows.' And for Elie Wiesel, God was dead in that moment." He writes about this in his book, Night. But that, thankfully, was not the end for Wiesel. Because he goes on to, after this, a life of moving slowly forward and writing and working for those who are oppressed. He writes books like Dawn. He begins to write about the biblical stories. And when he receives the Nobel Prize in 1986, he writes this. This is a man who had lost his faith entirely and then came back to it. He said this to the Nobel Committee. He says, "But I have faith. Faith in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Without it, no action would be possible." He says, "Our lives no longer belong to us alone. They belong to all those who need us desperately." What has God put before us that we are to do that is a work bigger than we know? That's his work. What is he doing right now in the midst of us that we do not see? May God show us, and may we be faithful to obey.